And now, from San Francisco and the UCSF Rosenman Institute, the Health Technology Podcast with your host, Christine Winoto.
Today, we are talking to Amar Salahi, the founder and CEO of Sipamet. I learned today that Amar wanted to be a doctor, but as you will hear, he decided engineering was more for him. He started out working as an engineer and transitioned into leadership, founding startups including Sutter Medical that was sold to Boston Scientific for more than $190 million, and ultimately launching his own incubator, Sipamet. Amar has a Midas touch as he has many successful big exits from the startups that he founded, including Apama that he sold for $300 million. His story is amazing, and Amar tells it best. In short, in this episode, you'll hear a rich account of creativity in engineering and entrepreneurship. I'm sure it bears many similarities to how Silicon Valley got started. I hope you enjoy our conversation. And if you like what you hear today, please subscribe to our podcast on your favorite app. Well, thanks, Amar, for joining me today. How are you doing with all this shelter in place?
You know, I'm doing well. I'm fortunate that we live in a place where the weather is nice. We have backyards. My parents live across the street, and my brother is on the other side of the street. So, you know, we've been less affected than most people. So I have to say I feel very fortunate that I also can work from home for the most part. And that's you know, not everybody can do that, unfortunately. So overall, we're doing well.
Well, that's good. Yeah, I think I feel the same way. You know, the ability that you have a place that you can shelter in, I think it's a privilege. Thankful for. I thought it would be great for our listener audience to hear a bit your background, you were a trained engineer, but how do you end up, you know, doing what you're doing now? And when you were doing health engineer, did you know that you want to be in the medical device space?
Yeah, I mean, when I was younger, when I was in high school, I was trying to figure out what I wanted to do. And I wanted to be not do the same as some of my other family members. And so a lot
Which
of my
is,
family members.
What did your family members do?
So I come from Syria, Lebanon, and a lot of people are into, you know, historically my grandfather and my uncles, you know, they're merchants or they're industrialists. So they started being merchants. Ultimately, they set up facilities, factories to do textile. So I would say that's sort of the background for my family in the region. And I think that was not my interest. I wanted to be different. And and I decided that, you know, medicine, it seemed interesting. It served people, but yet it was still a sort of somewhat of a glorified sort of profession. And so that's sort of, and I was thinking about that and really, you know, we had to leave Lebanon in 82 because of war. And so we went to South of France. My parents sent me and my brother to South of France for boarding school. And there, really, I started to prepare for coming to the U.S. I really was intent on being in the U.S. Medicine was really important to me. And so I was applying as a pre-med student into various universities in the U.S. and Canada. Ultimately, I got accepted and decided to go to Case Western Reserve because they have a very good medical school, but they also had a strong biomedical engineering program, which I was very keen and interested in. And I decided to do pre-med, sort of pre-med, biomed. You know, my undergrad would be engineering, prepping me hopefully to medical school. But I have to say, within the first year or two, I decided I was not really fit to be a physician.
Why is that?
I just saw some of the people who were really preparing themselves to become physicians, and the kind of work they were putting felt it was so academic and so intense, and it didn't seem to give enough latitude. I'm a person who doesn't really like too many rules and restrictions, and I wanted to explore more things besides academics. And I felt like being a physician and also preparing and essentially getting accepted was going to be, you know, quite hard for me. I couldn't devote all my time to academics. So I really said, look, I'm still interested in medicine, and I got to stay with the biomedical engineering. I really sort of, I felt like I should just stay with that and not necessarily the medicine part. And I was enrolled to be a biomedical engineer, and I ended up graduating with a biomedical engineering degree and an electrical engineering degree. So that's really how I did it. And I did a co-op, so an internship. And the internship ended up being with ACS. So that's really how it happened for me. I was lucky enough. There was a couple of people from ACS, which was owned by Eli Lilly at the time. And this is before it became Guided. And they had come to interview on campus. And I was speaking to this one person. His name was Tom Eddy. He was the HR person for Eli Lilly. And when I found out that, you know, I had done the homework on the company ACS, but I didn't know where Santa Clara was. There was no internet. It was quite difficult. I didn't even know what a catheter was. And when that guy told me, when Tom said, hey, look, yeah, we're in Santa Clara. We're only 35 miles away from San Francisco. I went ballistic. I was so excited, I was talking so fast and so enthusiastically that the guy thought I was having some sort of a problem. He said, are you okay? You want to slow down? But then things went well. I mean, and then he had me talk to Liz McDermott. And she, you know, we got along, and then essentially that turned into an interview process, which turned into a co-op sort of an internship at ACS, which ultimately led into me having a full-time position there.
I mean, I feel like I believe strongly about internship, the co-op program. I mean, that's why at the Roseman Institute, we have this internship program. I benefit a lot from internship, especially as a foreign student, sure. Having their internship help. To get the job.
Absolutely, Key. I mean, the thing for me is when I was looking for a job at the time, it was the ACS, Eli Lilly part, you know, the guidance thing. They were the only ones who did not require permanent residency. So I was really attracted to it. And all my peers were thinking of really big companies that, you know, I don't think turned out to be as exciting as what ACS turned out to be for me. But people were looking down and what is ACS? What is you know, they were all thinking different things. And I, you know, that was luck for me. I ended up stumbling onto interventional cardiology through that experience, which was really what changed my outlook on life and what I do every day.
I feel like a lot of people came out from ACS and they end up doing great things.
Yes. Yes. I think there's a good comparison between the sort of Fairchild, the first microchips are being made and designed microprocessors, and how all those people who were at Fairchild ended up starting so many other companies in Silicon Valley. And I think ACS really was probably playing that role because it was the first one that was really successful and it hadn't been done before. And it changed the industry. If you remember, you know, there was a number of valve companies in Southern California, but valve companies by the nature, they can't really change devices and technology very fast. Because you need so much data to really be able to say and justifications. So very important industry, critical industry, but also not as fast moving. Where you go to ACS and John Simpson and that company that was started and so forth, you know, we were launching products at the time, you know, once every, you know, 12 to 18 months. And that product would obsolete the prior version. And that was really a very interesting model, and it was invasive, but high volume compared to other things. And that really established a pattern, which I think the whole medical device industry more or less is relying on that same pattern of, minimally invasive, single use, and rapid iterations.
Right. And so you left ACS, and when does the entrepreneurship bug came?
So, I mean, again, I go back to my culture, history, family. People always, they never looked up to somebody who's an employee. So it's in the back of my mind, you had to sort of control your fate. So being a physician provided that for me, at least in my mind. I'm always in the back of my mind as I was studying engineers that ultimately I would hope to essentially control my own fate and work for myself as opposed to being, employed by a larger organization where I was one of thousands. So when I first joined ACS, even though it was, I think there was over 2,500 people or something like that when I started, with facilities in both, Silicon Valley and Temecula, if you remember. It was interesting. There was still that environment, that energy of startups, even though it was no longer a startup. It was a part of a big company. But there was an intercom in the ACS buildings, and people would call each other, John Smith call extension 133.
I remember those times. Yeah.
So there was always that. And then every once in a while, you'd heard, John Smith gone, and they would hang up. And that was somebody essentially announcing to the rest of the company that that person left. And my question was, what does that mean? Why did they go? Why did this person leave? Did they get fired? And pretty much most of the time is they left to join a startup or to start a startup. And when I started recognizing some of the names, I realized some of the better people were leaving. So it certainly sort of planted that seed that really, if you're really good and you want to go and do something else, you actually have to go and, join a smaller company and be part of a new thing. And so every time in my 6 years at ACS, every time I completed a project, I would actually go and talk to outside people. And when I finally was able to, I got myself a green card and so forth, and I found the right opportunity, I did that. I didn't really make a move until I was able to, which was at the end of 6 years. I joined Chuck Taylor at CTS. So I was one of the first engineers to be hired there. Ivan was just hired, and then I got hired. And, it was a very interesting journey with CTS.
And tell me more about that experience, about how is that different from ACS, and that probably give you more bug about wanting to start.
Yeah, I mean, CTS, we were literally just, when I joined, I think we were like less than 7 people, and we had no products in existence, and we had to figure it out. So you had to wear the multiple hats. So I got myself involved. Of course, I was an R&D person, but I was supporting in any which way I could, from hiring to a little bit of regulatory here and there, not doing it, but more identifying people and so forth and thinking through things. As the team grew, you got to be more and more specific into your area of expertise, which was design and early development. So it was a fascinating experience because literally we had zero products. There were some ideas and concepts that were quite interesting that Chuck had designed at the time. But what I was working on, which was the stabilization, there was no product. And we ran a number of experiments and eventually identified a sort of what works. And that was an interesting sort of a moment for me where we sort of, there was an aha moment, and that led to the development of that product. And then others like that. So we had a number of different products. They were not as difficult to move forward because they were surgical instruments. So we were able to actually get into the clinic rather fast and commercialize rather fast. But we were trying to really, really hard to do it in a way that an interventional cardiology company would. We were hoping and trying to come up with ways where the tools would be disposable so that we were able to essentially iterate often and come up with new technologies and so forth. Because the profit sort of model essentially necessitated some sort of a disposable. If people would only buy an instrument once and only once a year or once every 5 years, the market is not going to be certainly big enough to support additional development, additional technologies coming to bear. So that was a very interesting experience where the surgeons and the mindset of the nurses were to really, most of what they did when they were not doing surgery was really preparing the surgical set, sterilizing them so the physicians get to use them. It's the right ones for the right physicians. They all had different labels on the instruments. And that was a sort of an eye-opening experience. And it was not easy to essentially change the surgeon's perspective to really follow what the interventional cardiologists were starting, or had been doing for a while. And only until the percutaneous valve did they really sort of finally, I think, change a little bit, but still, that model is still challenged in terms of, most of the energies and investments and technology development is always going to be directed to higher volumes and people who adopt technology really, really fast. And those are the interventional cardiologists. So a phenomenal experience of CTS starting from scratch, going public in 6 months. That's, I think it's still a record. Not really knowing. I mean, when Rich Ferrara was going on the roadshow, some of the products were not even designed. They were basically barely conceptualized.
Those were the days.
Those were the days. I mean, that those days have never come back since then, because people are a lot more rigorous now and they do a lot more due diligence than they had in the past. But we went public and that was a very exciting time. You know, we did it. The first time we were using our device was in a live case in a conference. And the physician was so hesitant and so nervous that things didn't quite work out perfectly. And it was pretty intense. But eventually, you know,
the whole world was watching.
The whole world was watching. It was broadcast live from the surgical room to the amphitheater. And we were like, tighten the knob, tighten the knob. And we were all sort of internally screaming, tighten the knob. And he was focused on his surgery. He hadn't really used the device before. And we had just been completed the night before type of thing. So, but, you know, things did eventually sort of go the way we wanted to. And, you know, we were competing with Harport.
I know. I was at Harport.
Yes, you were at Harport. And you guys were doing really interesting things. And between the two companies, I think that competition sort of got a lot of press.
Yeah.
You know, some of it was good, some of it was not as good, but in general, it was very positive. And I think in some ways, the two companies helped each other. And that was a learning lesson for me, is that it's better to really all push in the same direction. You know, if one entity wins, it actually helps the others as opposed to the other way around. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. And probably it's good not to do your first case live.
That's right. Absolutely.
That probably like nerve-wracking. So after that, that's when you start. It's like, okay, now you're ready to start your own. Is that what?
Yeah. I mean, once I saw, because I was, Chuck was my first boss at ACS. And then he was the founder of CTS, the beating heart surgery company that I'm talking about that went public. So I saw him how he started. I mean, I had that experience, the fortunate experience of getting to know him. He's a very nice person, but also very creative and just an all around phenomenal individual. And but the fact that I was close to him, friends with him, and I saw the steps that he took when he first started by himself in the garage, I learned, you know, I absorbed these things and I essentially emulated that. And started in my garage, and I decided to, because I felt like he succeeded, then maybe I can succeed too. So the fact that I knew what success looks like and how I had personal sort of relationship with somebody that succeeded, it makes it less unreal. Right? It's concrete. It's a live example. It's approachable, doable, and so that really allowed me to go ahead and say to myself, let's go ahead and try to figure out how to do your own thing. So I started with an idea that wasn't terribly successful. And in order to survive, as I'm trying to sort of work my way through the whole thing, I started doing a lot of consulting. And my consulting business actually was doing quite well. And I abandoned my original concept of a startup of an idea that I was working on and pursued the consulting business wholeheartedly. Set up my garage as a lab, hired a lot of my friends. And then we started working, you know, took over the living room and dining room and the whole business. So the whole house was really full of people working, a lot of windsurfing friends of mine. And what I also ended up doing is ended up having roommates. So I would pay them and they would pay me rent back. So that was the kind of environment we were in, just day in and day out.
Frat house.
Kind of. But we were quite productive. And then one of our customers was Fred Pastrabi. And Fred and I, we had been talking, and he decided to sort of step away from Endotex to start a new company designing a filter. So we came up with a new idea of how to do a filter, which eventually we called it the filter wire. And the team started building prototypes, eventually that work started to really get some traction. I managed to be able to move out of the house into a facility, set up a clean room, continue to sort of increase the number of people in the organization. And it became very clear at some point that all the other projects were, you know, paled in comparison to the excitement of what we were doing with the filter, with the embolic filter. And then ultimately, Fred and I decided to sort of, he raised money. He was the only person. Finally raised a bigger amount of money, and we decided, we negotiated, and he and his company bought my company. So we merged. So all my employees became EPI employees. And so we became one company. I was VP of R&D. It was quite a thing for Fred to convince his VCs to do this. Because usually VCs don't like other, you know, their CEO to buy another company. That's just unheard of. But he managed to convince them, and it really accelerated things because the system was in place, the facility was in place, the people were there. And we were able to get into the clinic. And he went and did all those cases. And then a year later, we sold the company to Boston Scientific.
That's great. I mean, it's good. It sounded like, your first time you hit it, but it took you a while to get there.
Yeah. I mean, there was a long period where I was consulting in the house by myself, and I would be, I'm a very social person. I like to talk to people and so forth. And I would be so ready to pull my hair apart, looking at the computer, doing my SolidWorks and whatnot. And I would be so desperate to talk, I would go and talk to the dry cleaner. Just to have somebody to talk to, give her stuff to do for me, or hardly anything, or mend a fence or something. And then I started talking to the machine shop people. There's a lot of machine shop people in Campbell. And I realized they were similar to me. Some of them had their own shop, but they were sort of by themselves. And so when a customer came, they wouldn't stop talking.
This podcast is sponsored by Ron Ratnick's Global Life Sciences Group, a team of legal professionals that helps life science companies, lenders, and investors around the world turn good science into good business. Learn more at ronratnick.com.
So, yeah, there was a lot of difficult times because you didn't know if you were going to get an income. But, slowly, surely, things worked out, and ultimately, the EPI project turned out to be a winner with ups and downs, with failures and successes.
And what keep you going? Because you could have just gone back to the corporate world at that time.
I had when I left CTS, I had to, it was a decision I had to make. Should I just start my own, or should I join another company and so forth? And I put this big spreadsheet for myself and trying to sort of put the pros and cons. And it was, I was getting myself wrapped up around that thought process. And I said, this is ridiculous. I threw out the spreadsheet and I said, I got to do what my gut tells me. And my gut tells me I got to do the fun, exciting thing and start this thing. And if I don't do it now, I'll never do it. I wasn't married. I didn't have any kids. And I said, I'm not going to starve to death. Maybe I'll be hungry for a little bit, but and so I decided to make that choice, and I'm so glad that I did.
Yeah, well, that's great. And then, so after the success of EPI, then you start another company.
Yeah. For me, starting a new company is extremely exciting. It's super rewarding. So for me, it doesn't feel like work. It feels like, I'm obsessed by it. Think about it all the time when I'm driving, when I'm, before going to sleep. And so it's constant. And I think it sort of needs that in order to succeed, as long as you don't, drive yourself crazy. So yeah, EPI was a great success. It gave me certain financial stability. And then I wanted to do a new company. And I decided to focus on things where I could leverage my interventional cardiology engineering skills and sort of try and do innovation. Because without that, I felt, and that's what I bring to the table. And I had become aware of PVT, which got sold to Edwards. This is the percutaneous valve, and another company called CoreValve. And I saw what they were doing. And my thought was, what they're doing is phenomenal. This is going to change is going to change the cardiology, period, in a huge way. People were, you know, reasonably skeptical. They had only done a few cases. And they had some, you know, amazing successes, but also some challenging times and some deaths and things like that. But my choice was, okay, if they've succeeded, they're gonna continue doing well. They'll evolve their system. And why don't we come up with something better? And that's really what set me up. I immediately reached out to Dr. Don Bain, who was very close to us, who was working with us very closely with EPI at the time, and Dr. Paul Spence, the surgeon. You know, Dr. Bain, of course, you know, passed away, unfortunately, but he was an amazing individual, one of the smartest physicians, engineers, because he had an engineering background. So he was very perceptive. And Paul Spence also was a very accomplished surgeon, also very oriented towards technology, innovation. He's also, in his own right, a very creative person with a number of successes in technology development. So I reached out to them. Of course, I reached out to Fred and started talking to a whole bunch of people I didn't know, because I didn't know anything about valves. I didn't know how a valve was made and why anything worked. So I spent a huge amount of time reaching out and connecting with various people to just learn and understand what it would take, who could help me, and so forth. And eventually, we came up with some concepts that made sense. We raised seed financing from angel investors, people who had sort of seen what I had done at EPI, who were supportive. And they all put in small amounts of money. It turned to a million or so. I got some money from some VCs as part of that sort of seed round. And ultimately raised a series one, you know, series A with what was Pequot. Julia Backer was the person who sort of led that round. And that was the start of Sadra Medical, the percutaneous company. We were in the house again. We had set up the lab. Different house this time around, bigger house. So we had a lot more people in the house, up to the point where the cops came and said, what are you guys doing here? We had so many cars outside. The neighbors got upset. They couldn't park. You know, they'd come home and they couldn't park their cars. So somebody sort of told the police on us, and the cops showed up. They said, this is illegal. Uh-huh. And I go, look, I have the lease here. Just give us a few more days and we're going to go to our facility. We got funding. We're ready to go. And they wouldn't have any of it. They were really upset with me. So I'd say, okay. Yeah, we'll leave right now. So everybody left. I mean, literally we had 15, 17, 18 people in the house. It was a lot. and we were quite productive because we had to set up quite an elaborate facility, you know, lab. I had one in the garage, I had one in the shed, and I was even using my parents' to do the chemical stuff. So,
My God, no wonder the police freaked out.
Yeah. So, but what happened was I immediately asked Leah at the time to rent a car, a van for us. And what we would do, we'd have everybody park at the facility, which was 5 minutes away in Campbell. And then people would pile into the van and do two shuttles every morning and drive everybody to the house. And then one person had a motorcycle, he would get the motorcycle and come to my house. So like for a number of weeks, there was no cars outside. So look, but inside was full of people. And we had this show. And then the cops came for a different reason. They were chasing some vagrant in the neighbor's house or whatever it was. And they said, we got our eyes on you. You know, we didn't forget about you. And lo and behold, they didn't realize that we had the same number of people, but they're all inside.
It's like you're having a party.
Yeah. Well, they didn't see anybody because they didn't go inside. So that was fun. We won't forget that. It's sort of part of our stories.
Yeah, that sounds like a fun. It's always fun when you get involved with police, but nobody get arrested, I suppose. Yes. So that was a good success story with Sadra.
Yes.
And you had the exit before the 08?
No, the exit came later. I think I left Sadra. We did first in man, and then we brought another CEO. So I stayed with Sadra as a CEO for about 5 years, and then the last year we brought another CEO, Ken Martin, and I wanted to start the next thing. I had already spent a lot of time on the valves. I was eating, thinking, drinking valves for so long that I really was looking forward to just a different project. And so that's really when I said, okay, I really enjoy the startup. I like hiring the people. I really enjoy, you know, literally starting from scratch. And so I said, let's do this again, but this time around, let's try to do it in a way where I can keep the infrastructure so I don't have to spend so much time doing a lot of this setup, you know, establishing admin, hiring, you know, trying to figure out a way where I can cycle through new companies without having to spend a lot of time putting basic infrastructure together so that you can immediately start working on the technology and not worry about HR or facilities or accounting and things like that. So that was the intent. But it took a long time before that sort of concept really took proper form. We were doing multiple things even early on, but we were mostly focused typically on one project at a time. And at some point, we started doing more significant efforts. It's really only after we sold Maya that we were able to do multiple projects simultaneously in a more sort of deliberate effort.
Is it because you have more experience or you have more funding or you have more people?
It's all of these things, but mostly it's related to others and investors. So investors usually don't really like this idea of somebody doing multiple things, right? They want to invest in one company, one project, and they want everybody focused on it. They don't want CEO or founder to go and get distracted with yet another company that they haven't invested in. And they want really success before they look into other things. So for me to do multiple things simultaneously was not sort of practical or doable. As a matter of fact, in one of our financings for Apama, they asked me to essentially step away from some of the activities so that theoretically I'm not distracted by these other activities. And then only when we had, you know, the Maya success, it was harder for people to say, no, we don't want you to do this, right? There was enough success. I had enough of, yeah, if you're not interested, if you're going to put these kinds of mandates, then I'll find other people to work with. So it took a lot of effort for me to be able to establish the model. And also I was following Fred's model because he had the Incept model and how he set it up. But usually, Fred at the time was working also in a serial fashion, one at a time. But the whole idea of an incubator and spinning multiple companies and how to establish that, I certainly also leveraged what I'd learned from Fred and Incept and how he's done it with his partner, Mark. But really couldn't implement it and couldn't essentially mandate, here's how I'm going to work. If you're interested, we'll work together. You can be my investor. Only was able to be sort of implemented when I had the ability to mandate, the ability to say, if you're not willing to do this, then I'll find somebody else, essentially. And that's what took that long. And so, I mean, the idea of Shivamed and the incubator started in 2008, 2009. I wasn't able to properly sort of bring that vision to life until we sold Amaya, which was probably in 2011 or 12 or something like that.
Well, so also at that time was also a very challenging time too. So
It was.
That is harder than any other period.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, when we started the whole idea of the incubator, none of the incubators had been successful yet, at least to my knowledge. There may be some that have been, but the Foundry had done a lot of interesting things, but I don't think they had any exits yet. And people were sort of frowning about this whole idea. Because VCs, in general, they like to see patterns that work and try to duplicate them, especially when they have a portfolio. And it's certainly a pattern was not to have people do multiple things. And it's just, even today, we don't do that. Like when today we start a company, we want to make sure the R&D guys are focused on an individual single project, so that they're successful, so they really get it to the right place. Only the G&A functions, accounting and facilities and HR and so forth, are shared amongst the companies. That allows people to right away, they have what they need in terms of accounting and budgets and systems and processes, and they can get to work right away in doing their R&D. So that's really what we do today at Shivamed, is allow people to focus and be innovative, have each company able to pivot, make decisions. They're empowered and they're focused. So we want to preserve that, but we want to get the economies of scale by, the other infrastructure that's non-specific that gets shared and you get economies of scale from that.
How does each of your portfolio company get started? Like the idea come from the outside, or is it more from you? Or
it's usually from within. It's really coming from us on the inside. We haven't really, we've done only one joint project, which is Vivera. This is the 4D ICE company. This is 3D ultrasound intercardiac echo company, where we've worked with GE. And so we use their sensor and their consoles and software, and we do the catheter. But other than that, we've done everything sort of homegrown. What we usually do is identify an area of interest, meaning a new set of procedures and devices that there's a lot of enthusiasm around, either because the market is looking to be very interesting or it's already a market. You know, either people are convinced it's going to be a market or the market is already in existence. And, you know, because as I was doing EPI, I was trying to figure out what to do. And I was analyzing why were we so successful at EPI. And I think because I've seen when I was consulting, I saw a lot of different companies do a number of different things. And many of them failed. And why did EPI succeed? And my perspective was that it was already a company ahead of us that had proven that protecting the brain from emboli is important, right? And so we were not the first ones. Somebody had sort of paved the way, convinced the world, you know, did clinical studies and succeeded. And so we said, you know, let's be the better technology. Let's be a fast follower. So that model really captivated me because it reduced fundamental risk, scientific risk, but really put the risk on the execution and the engineering, which is an area that I'm comfortable with. You know, you'd hate to spend 5+ years on a project and find out that the physiology or the science doesn't work. So that's really how we like to operate. And, you know, EPI was very much that way. We were not the first to do this kind of work, but ultimately we're the first filter on the market and being the most successful. Certainly at the beginning, probably still not. So that is really how I think of the world. And when we look to a new project, that's what we're looking for. We're looking for an area where there's enough scientific evidence that this concept is likely to be successful. And then we go about trying to figure out, okay, what did the first generation product, what did the pioneers miss? What did they deprioritize because they had to get, let's say, some more fundamentals done? That's what we do. We identify gaps in technologies or places where you can have significant improvements, where we can differentiate ourselves in the features and the technology. So we like to bring new technology to bear into an area that's already demonstrated to be super valuable in the market size by being interesting enough, where we're likely to get an early exit. So we look at that from the very beginning. Because I don't want to work on a project that takes 10 to 15 years. You know, Sadervalve, we started the company in 2003, and I think they started commercializing last year. It took that long, right? I couldn't be in that same project for all those years. That's not possible for me. You know, just like I can go be a medical student, it's the same thing. I have only a certain amount of patients, and I need to see something different and be part of another growth sort of activity. So we like to start the companies from scratch by identifying first a really interesting market where we can get an early exit, where, you know, the business development people of the large corporations are already interested in it. They just can't execute on it fast enough. So our job really is to service that industry, is to say, okay, there's one company that's likely to be bought by one strategic, but the rest of the strategics need a solution as well. Our job is to really provide that. And that's what we like to do. So we end up doing most of that work in-house. And we generate those ideas in-house. Usually it's just a 1, 2, 3, 4 people. That's it. And we can work on a project for a year or two. And only when we think we've checked all the boxes, that everything is looking good from a technology, from a physician adoption, from a market size, regulatory, clinical reimbursement, all those topics, all those things, they have to essentially be there for us. And we spend a year or two making sure that all these things are in existence. Once we have verified all these things, then we bring institutional investors and external investors to be part of the process. So that's sort of how we do things. Because we want to have we want to always be successful. Because if you're successful, it's much easier to, of course, get other people to come back and invest again. That's certainly a big lesson learned for us. You know, when we were successful with EPI, it was very easy to convince people to come back and be part of the next adventure. So that's really how we do things. So we identify those things and move them forward. And when we're ready, we bring institutional investors.
Well, I mean, you have that track record. It's like one after the other. I think one time I told you have the Midas touch. I just need to follow you around.
Thank you.
Now, you know, with this whole pandemic, what do you think? What's going to happen for the industry? I mean,
I think you already see what's happening. I think I don't think you need a lot to be super perceptive. There's going to be clear winners, not just in medical healthcare and whatnot, but in general, in the economy and in our society. This is clearly a sort of a key moment. This is the every so many years, some big event happens. This is our big event, and it's a huge one. It's changing a number of things. I think it's accelerating some dramatic trends, and I think for healthcare, it's really about telemedicine, remote monitoring, and those types of things, cloud-based computing, and also. So those things were already interesting. People were investing in those areas. I think what COVID has shown us is that it's going to accelerate this. People want to, you know, if they can work from home, if they can avoid contact with others, if they, there's a number of benefits for these things even before COVID, but with COVID, it's just accelerated those trends. But I think it's also affected, at least temporarily, other sort of segments of our industry. You know, certainly elective procedures got hurt bad when nobody wanted to do any sort of elective procedure. And I imagine that some of the companies that were not maybe as diversified, maybe we'll start thinking about, let's have some diversification. Perhaps maybe that's what they think, maybe not. But yeah, some companies have done better than others. You just have to look at the stock market. The ones that had the ability to benefit from testing and vaccines have done well. You know, their stock values, you know, their market cap has gone up. And the ones who had nothing, that they couldn't really contribute much to COVID, and they've seen, you know, utilization of their products dip dramatically, you know, they've been hurt. It's not been good for them. So it's not a survival problem. I think it's going to affect them at least temporarily. But I don't think overall they're going to be threatened. It's just not going to look good for a period of time until we get over this. Until, you know, elective procedures, which have come back. To a large extent, elective procedures are being done. Now, the concern is if there's a lot more new COVID cases, is that going to go back and reduce elective procedures? Hard to say. But
in Texas, they're starting to do that, right? I think they just announced it today. But so, at CivaMed, are you thinking about technology that come up as with solution, innovation, innovative solution that can, you know, address the impact of COVID-19?
So we thought about it. We discussed some joint ventures with people who are doing testing and so forth, but it ultimately didn't really pan out for a number of reasons, mostly sort of business reasons. I would love to be able to do something that impacts this disease. But I think at the end of the day, you have to play to your strengths. There's a number of already either projects or companies or technologies that were already in the works. You know, if there's already 50 companies doing one thing, I'm not sure that our role is to go and learn from the start about something like that. We don't have the diagnostic testing expertise. That's not something we've done in the past. So for us to insert ourselves quickly didn't make sense there. On the ventilator, I also felt like there's a number of ventilator companies out there and a bunch of people trying to come up with really simple solutions, which I think is valuable, but ultimately for us, it didn't make sense. I think it's easier for established companies to ramp up and provide the better quality care than for, you know, other efforts or what we would have been, you know, tried to do, which would have been very difficult. And so, even though we thought about it and explored it a little bit, we didn't really pursue it. What we did do, though, is accelerate some things that we were doing that made sense then and make even more sense today. So we have a project that's about heart failure and remote monitoring. And so that project continued to move forward. And I think is going to get even more of an interest as we fundraise for it right now. We have also been working on a company to really do enterprise software. So one of the problems that we always try to solve for ourselves is establish processes and systems when you can, especially when that's specifically related to a particular product. So, you know, when we set up a PO system, you know, you don't need to recreate a PO system for each individual company, portfolio company. Or if I do a document release system, you know, I don't want to go back and recreate it. So we were using some off-the-shelf software for this kind of stuff, and then we decided to go ahead and build our own. And so we're doing a cloud-based system to really run the medical device companies so that the manufacturing, the R&D, and the quality system, so that our portfolio companies can use it. But also now we want to be able to have it to all the industry. So hopefully gets the benefit from that, especially the smaller and medium-sized companies. So those are the things that we're doing. Not that's different than what COVID, prior COVID, because these activities clearly started before COVID. But I think COVID has only, I would say, accelerated the enthusiasm or the interest, because they, you know, working remotely, leveraging cloud-based sort of solutions is definitely, we've all learned to survive and work with Zoom and sharing folders. And we've been doing it before. We're just doing it a lot more than we ever did, you know, with COVID. And I think that's the same thing for the companies we have in the portfolio right now.
Well, that's great. And last question before I let you go. What is your one advice or two to early stage entrepreneur at this time, at this, you know, during this pandemic time?
What is my advice? I think it's not different from, you know, the early days. I think you really need to pick something you're passionate about and dedicate yourself to it. Find a way to spend more time on that to be successful with it, because you can't really be an entrepreneur part-time. I mean, you may start that way, but very quickly you've got to sort of dedicate yourself. So my advice is, to really be successful, you have to really go sort of head first. And it also goes with the way, you know, you can't just think about a product or file some provisionals. You really, it's usually not as valuable, or it doesn't become fundable unless you start actually doing it. It's not all theory, and it's not all just a bunch of, but you have to sort of immerse yourself into it and start working on it to identify the issues, to really come up with interesting solutions. So that's sort of my perspective on that.
Well, that's great. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you, Christine. Pleasure to talk to you. And an honor to be here.
Thank you for listening today. And don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes.